So these next 3 days, I'm going to be here rambling. today, tomorrow, and next day, that's right, three. About spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. And we'll see how far we get. It might be more of a ramble than anything else. I'm hoping to leave some time for questions each week, and we'll finish at 6:45. So normally we'll just start just with a little bit of a brief meditation, just like that, just to bring us into the room. Then I'll ramble a bit, and then we'll have some questions and finish. My main theme that I've chosen is spiritual death, spiritual rebirth. But to talk about that, I need to talk about the whole system of practice in our movement that Bhante, the founder, Sangharakshita, has outlined, has sort of laid out for us. I don't know how many people are aware of the system of practice, but it's that system that I want to explore this evening. It comes originally out of a set of lectures that Sangharakshita gave about the system of meditation and his vision of what meditation really is trying to achieve, but really extends to the whole of the spiritual life. And just recently, in these recent interviews between Bhante and Subhuti, Bhante has been bringing out this system of practice more, and wants it, I think, to be presented more in our centres, to be understood more deeply in our centres. And for that aim, I'm going to be writing a book on it. I'm going to be writing another course book on the five great stages of the path. And because I'm an expert, I need to think out loud. So I need people in front of me so I can think. So I'm afraid your preparation for my book, I'm afraid you probably won't be credited for it. the system of practice, let's just plunge into it. So you've got the principle of integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and receptivity, which becomes eventually spontaneous compassionate activity. Yeah. So there you go. That's it in a nutshell. You could all go home now and go to the cinema or something. So what I want to do is, through the next 3 days, just explore the whole system, especially spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. Are people aware of this system of practice?
No.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are. Sure. So the first thing to say about it, I'll explain the terms more and more, is that they're both a description of, a telescopic description of an ideal spiritual life, starting with integration, moving on to positive emotion, moving then further on to spiritual death, out of that arising spiritual rebirth, and out of that arising spontaneous compassionate activity. So in one way, it describes an ideal or even idealized spiritual life, yeah? So that the stages are laid sequentially. But in another way, it stands for the five great elements which need to be in your spiritual life, actually really from day one. It's this aspect of it that's being brought out more and more and that I want to particularly bring out. So I don't think I'm very I'm not so interested in talking about them as sequential steps, although I might do that. I don't know actually what I'm going to talk about. I might do that. Mainly I'm interested in them is as aspects of spiritual life. I'm actually getting more and more interested in this. I'm going to be leading a weekend on it just this weekend coming. One of the big questions for me, I think, is, you know, there's this great big thing called the spiritual life. What does it really contain? What does it entail? And how do I know if I'm making practice? And how can I make sure that my spiritual life is a balanced affair? Yeah? I think these five great stages can help us with those questions. What can happen, and one of the things that I'm personally a bit concerned about, is a tendency of thinking of spiritual practice in terms primarily of meditation. In the RBC, we even used to have practice nights, which means meditation practice nights. I'm concerned about that because I keep on hearing that that what Buddhism is really is meditation, which becomes a sort of noble one-fold path. There's only one fold of the eightfold path. And I sometimes fear that we're becoming meditationists rather than Buddhists, if you see what I mean. This is not, of course, to undervalue meditation. It's a very, very valuable practice, central practice, really, to Buddhist life. And yes, I'd be hoping us all to be deepening our meditation practice, but it's only one aspect of a whole spiritual life. So last night, for instance, I came to the men's chapter meeting in Oritar, and really that whole evening was devoted to exploring our communication between each other, exploring how people were getting on, the history of their communication. And that felt to me an intensely spiritual practice. People were having to take risks to say things that they didn't, that they felt nervous to say, that they felt unsure that they could say. Other people were having to listen sometimes to quite hard things being said about them, and having to find out if there was truth in that and to what degree the truth was. It needed concentration, it needed receptivity, it needed courage, and so on. For me, it was very clearly an evening of spiritual practice, and I felt uplifted for it, just as I would have spent an evening in meditation. So whilst I don't want to undermine the value of meditation, I think the value of these stages of the practice might help us see what the five great areas of life that we're really trying to practice in our life. Whether we're here in the shrinery meditating, whether we're, as I was at the weekend on Saturday, looking after a 4 and 5 year old, by golly, that's a bit of practice, or whether we're on the bus and at work and so on. So I want to start a little bit by, perhaps we should talk about some key terms. Now perhaps I should start off by giving a brief overview of all of those five, just to help us. Just to say, I should have said that if I arrange them sequentially, they end with spontaneous compassionate activity, or sometimes that stage is called no more effort. Sounds good. Everyone's keen on that stage. So you could say that, yes, after you have integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and no more effort, or sometimes it's called no more learning. So it's called all of those three things: from spontaneous compassionate activity, the stage of no more effort, or no more learning. When you lay them out horizontally to show the aspects of one spiritual life, that becomes receptivity. So that principle of no more effort, no more learning, interestingly spontaneous compassionate activity, becomes a principle of receptivity. So when we look at them as aspects of spiritual life, we're looking for an aspect that's to do with integration, an aspect that's to do with positive emotion, an aspect to do with receptivity, an aspect to do with spiritual death, and an aspect to do with spiritual rebirth. And it's tend to point in the middle like that. So integration, first of all. I want to try and talk more about integration today, because I think I've got a lot more thinking to do about integration. It's one of those words that you can bandy about quite easily. It's got different meanings in different contexts, and it'd be interesting to be clearer what Bantu means by this, and it'd be interesting to see what particularly Buddhism has got to say about this. But it basically, I think, means cultivating wholeness, so that you're just one person, so that you're not, Bantu's talked about it in terms of that you're not a sort of group of people in conflict with each other, you're not a group of conflicting selves. So the obvious example is always, you have an inspiring class, you feel really, if you want to practice spiritual life, you vow to yourself as you go to bed to get up and meditate, and then you wake up in the morning and you want to stay under your duvet. So whoever went to bed doesn't seem to be the person who's got up. You may not only have a very dim remembrance of the person who went to bed and was so terribly inspired by all this. So one way of thinking about integration, I think it is only one way, is that you try to become, that you practice to become just one person. I'll come back to that, because I think I mainly want to talk about that tonight. Then we've got this stage of positive emotion. This is an easy stage, in the sense that I think the title itself isn't very helpful. I've got problems with positive, and I've got problems with emotion. So that the problem with the word positive is it so easily can be taken wrongly, that it means just being up, if you mean, in a jolly mood. I've got somebody I know who is sort of happy at me, if you mean. He seems to need someone to aim his happiness at, his upness at. And I found it, frankly, irritating. Hi, how are you? You think, oh, no, I'm not very good. Oh, well, what a shame. How about you actually listen? So if you're not, it doesn't mean just being up. It doesn't mean just being bubbly and up. They come to think, actually, by the way, that this sort of this bubbly up character is partly just genetic. It just depends on your genetic loading. They think at the moment about 50% of your characteristics are genetic. It doesn't mean to say you can't change them, but some of them are just like that. They're just the kind of person you are. So just being an up bubbly person doesn't mean that you don't do the positive emotion state. Emotion is also tricky because in a way the whole question of emotion is rather problematic, because there's no word in Buddhism that exactly corresponds to it. You've got Vedana and Citta. We're very concerned about our emotions, but we're not always very clear what they are, and very often much of our emotional life is rather low key, isn't it? People only have this sort of huge emotional life in soap operas, when your affair is always being discovered in a soap opera. So it might be better to think of it as kusala karma, which means skillful action, stage of skillful action. Kusala means skillful, and karma means neat action. So it's a stage of ethics, really. In other words, it's saying that if you want to change yourself, if you want to have a new experience of your own consciousness, you need to act in a different way. You need to act in ways that express positive states of mind and not negative mechanism states of mind and so on. So it might be better to think of it as a stage of skillful action. Then you've got this stage of receptivity, if we're looking at it horizontally like this. So this is the stage of just being at the aspect of spiritual life. It's not really a stage in this way I'm talking, actually. The aspect of spiritual life, which is to do with just noticing what's there already. Perhaps one danger of a path model of spiritual life is to always think that the fruits are going to be in the future, that you need to act now for the future. Do you see what I mean? Then there's value in that, obvious value in that. But if you're never careful, if you're not careful, you never appreciate that you are now in your own future, from the past point of view. Do you see what I mean? So we need to be making sure that we're not just future orientated all the time. So there needs to be an aspect of our spiritual life which is just about just being receptive, just being open, just noticing what's there, and so on. Being receptive, I'll come back more to it because there's a lot more to say, but just being open, just not trying to do anything, not trying to cultivate anything, just being open to what's there just now. And then there's a stage of spiritual death. I mean, spiritual death, I like this title, spiritual death, because it communicates the seriousness of this. So spiritual death is like a death. It's not just a kind of term. It is like a death. It is a kind of death. And spiritual life, at its most positive even, leads to a kind of death. If it doesn't lead to a kind of death, it's not really a spiritual life. Now, one of the values of this idea of spiritual life is that it shows very clearly that our spiritual life is not just about feeling good. It's not just about relaxing, it's not just about feeling more integrated, feeling more positive, feeling more receptive. It's actually about dying. You won't get this in any feel-good books, you know. It's not about you feeling good, it has to be about you dying. Actually, the only way for you to finally feel good is to die, but that's another way. Now, that doesn't mean to say it undermines feeling good, it doesn't mean to say it undermines the value of mindfulness, of metta-bhavana, of generosity, of all those positive things you do, but there are inbuilt problems in even those very good things. You're trying to use the self to go beyond yourself, and there comes a point where that becomes self-contradictory. Is it what I mean? That you have to let go of even that. But letting go is too sweet a way of putting it. You have to actually die. Yeah. And in this vision of spiritual life, that's an aspect of spiritual life, that needs to be something you're cultivating now, is dying. And I want to talk about how we can do that, how we can die more. If anything, what many situations need is more spiritual death, as much as more positive emotion. It's something that I'm trying personally to think about more. Then you've got this stage of spiritual rebirth. Spiritual rebirth, as an aspect, is this possibility of transcendence. So there is something that lies beyond the range of our egotism. That there is, as it were, another thing. There is, as it were, very poetically speaking, some other force in the world, some other beneficial force in the universe, which is trying to break through into the small house of our cautionary being, as George Stein puts it. Spiritual rebirth is often experienced as something coming beyond the self into the self. The image of it in Western art is the image of the Annunciation, of the angel breaking into the house of the Virgin, as it were. Something quite beyond our normal range of experience, beyond us, really. And because it feels so unusual to us, it feels like it comes from outside of us. It's a place usually designated for God, but of course Buddhists don't believe in God. Or you could say that for Buddhists, the language of God is not a language that we find useful or helpful. So recently I was meeting somebody I've got to know through the poetry world, and she's, thinks of herself as a Christian, and I was saying, well, tell me about the experiences you have which you think of being divine, and let's talk about those experiences rather than what we want to call them. And Buddhism might have a lot in common with those experiences, but wouldn't want to use the language of God because, Buddhists would say it's an unhelpful language, it's not a useful language. But we shouldn't think that because we don't want to use that language, there isn't a kind of divine. Now, there isn't a literal kind of divine in the sense of some kind of animating God behind things. We don't want to reify this. But we don't want to think that all there is us. Do you see what I mean? That there just are selves. Because then spiritual life just does become just a feel-good practice, doesn't it? That what I'm trying to do with my spiritual life is be a happier, healthier, better self. Whereas Buddhism is saying, actually, yes, that's part of it, but yourself needs to die, and something else needs to take its place, as it were. Difficult to talk about because it sounds so potentially theistic, and it's definitely not. So those are our stages, our aspects, as it were, just very briefly outlined. You've got integration, and each of these aspects has a particular meditation practice associated with it. So that's clearly the practice of the mindfulness of breathing. In fact, mindfulness generally, particularly body mindfulness, and mindfulness of breath is really a deepening of body mindfulness. So mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of the self is your practice to cultivate integration. Positive emotion or kusala karma is clearly the metta-bhavana, is your primary obvious focus practice where you practice loving kindness. Receptivity is clearly the practice of just sitting, where you just sit. Spiritual death, a practice that you may not have done yet, because in our system of practice, we expect you to, we feel that you need to have done these other practices first before you can do these practices. But there's something like the contemplation and the six elements, six element practice, where you consciously reflect on the elements of your experience and try and find if there's any self in them. And you find, surprise, surprise, there's not. I think we might be gradually bringing in more practices like this, not that practice itself, but other practices, to start to point towards this. But it's a practice where you start to realise that you're clinging on to self. You're thinking of self in your body. Where is it in your body? Which part of your body is self? You think of your body, yourself, in terms of the elements of yourself. Where is self to be found? Where is this self that we're trying to grab hold of, trying to clutch onto? And you have to really, in that practice, you're trying to see through the delusion of self. It's interesting, it's not a sacrifice, because self in itself is a delusion. We're kind of inhabited by the ghost of self. And all we're trying to do in spiritual death is realise it's a ghost. It doesn't really exist. It's actually not even a ghost, because ghosts have a sort of existence. Perhaps it is a ghost, you know, it's a great ghost in Mahabhuta. So the six element practice associated with that, and then the stage of spiritual rebirth is indicated by the sadhana practice that many order members take when they're ordained, where you visualize a Buddha and Bodhisattva for you, a sadhana practice. Again, there are only practices that we take on when we're ordained, and I'll say perhaps later on a bit the reason why. But that's only to talk of them in terms of those practices are the, you could think of an epitome of those great aspects. Yeah. And what I want to do is start to look at other ways, other practices that cultivate those aspects of spiritual life. Sangharakshita is saying that all we need to do in our life is make sure that we're practicing these five things every day. In fact, I'm trying to create a kind of diary, which eventually I will hope to become a kind of spreadsheet, where you can actually fill in your daily practice. This I'm going to actually start trying it this weekend, where you just think, okay, how have I done in integration today? How have I done with positive emotion? How have I done with spiritual death, etc., etc.? And you can kind of fill it in. Eventually I want it to be an app that you can download. I'm so now. So let's start talking a bit about integration and perhaps a bit about positive emotional kusala dharma, karma. And I'll move on from there. Any questions though so far before I move on? All quite straightforward. For some of you it might be a little bit new, so some of you it might not be.
Spiritual death.
Spiritual death. Over the top, right, okay. Yes, so spiritual death as a, perhaps I will just mention that some things there was a bit of practice there, so we can start to get a bit more of a handle on that. It's really any time as an aspect of your practice where you have to let go of you. In small ways, yes, and in large ways. So it's, for instance, when you have to say, I'm sorry, I was wrong then. One of the things that we could benefit humanity is being able to say, sorry about that, I was wrong. Yes, I thought that, but actually, I was wrong. I'm sorry. Yeah? To do that, you have to let go of yourself a bit, don't you? You have to die a bit. You have to admit to yourself and to other people that you're not always right. That you're not always right. Yeah? And there's a sort of depth in that, isn't there? You see what I mean? I remember one of my strong experiences of that in this at that level. Of course, you can keep going up and deep in this level, but when I was on sabbatical, I was writing and trying to write a book about Buddhism and art. It's something I've been trying to do for many years. I still hope to do it one day. Anyway, that's another. And I went on this sabbatical and I was writing every day for quite a long time on this book and working on it very hard. I was on the sabbatical 7 months. About 4 months into my sabbatical, a good friend of mine came to see me, and I'd been working on this book, and he read the book. I'd written a lot of it by then, probably about halfway. He read the book, and he said that he was neither impressed with the book or with me. And this is where you're trying to compose your face, you know. Really? What can you say? So this is me, but I've been writing it for 4 months. It would be my whole intention of being there. So he said, I'm not impressed with the book, and I'm not impressed with your states of mind writing this book. I think you should stop. And it was really an interesting experience because I couldn't say anything. Half of my psyche wanted to say, yes, no, you don't understand, I want to write it, it's really important, I can write it, da da da. Another half of my psyche knew immediately he was right. Immediately, instinctively, that he was right. And I couldn't speak. It was really odd. I just couldn't answer. And eventually I said, okay. I'll stop. And I literally haven't looked at it since that day. What was interesting, after that, my whole sabbatical sort of flowered. Suddenly, I don't know, my whole experience just opened up, just by stopping. It was like I'd got this idea of me and what I was doing, and it was actually not the right idea, and it wasn't doing me or the book any good. But I was really fixated on it. I really thought, no, that's what I want to do, that's what's important. And it was a death to say, okay, I won't do it. And then not really know what else I was going to do, you know. There I was for months, mostly on my own. And this was going to be my thing, you know, I was going to come back with this book. So that was a kind of death. In a way, it makes it much easier if there's examples, doesn't it?
In his dying then, spiritual dying, rather than death, it sounds like it's just like once you're dead, you've done it,
is it? Right, yes.
Is dying, or you're just trying to keep dying?
Or lots of little deaths. Yeah. I think at a pertinent point, it becomes death when you actually completely see through self.
Yeah.
You know, where you just, a bit like someone saying, to see you, to see all these things you've done in your life, wanting things and don't want, I'm not impressed with them. I don't think much of it. And you can actually think, actually, you know, nor do I. And you can just let that go. If you can imagine that, then that would be a full-out spiritual death, where you just stop always trying to get things to enhance the self, always trying to push away things that threaten the self. You just give up the whole darn thing, and then a new, wholly new vision arises. So at that point it becomes death, capital D. You can either have lots of little deaths up to then, or a practice of dying. So you can't do that, you can't approach that, unless there's enough integration and enough positive emotion. You can't do it. You won't be able to do it. I remember how I had this very, very strong solitary retreat, and solitary retreats, for instance, I think are a practice in spiritual death. You get there, you turn up, you unpack your stuff, and you think, hang on, I don't like being on my own. That's what I do. Okay, they're really great, I've got all my stuff, I unpack, now what do? And you think, oh my God, I'm here for 2 weeks, and nothing's happening, you see? And you know, you have to place that sort of great hole. Distracting my other quite saying that. Yes, to die you have to be positive and integrated enough. So I remember having this very, very strong solitary retreat that's actually one of the most frightening experiences I've ever had. I had this terrible fear, this terrible existential dread. And it wasn't anymore to do with some axe murderer is going to come across and get me. Actually they need to bring a packed lunch into me. And a flask and quite a lot of water, you know, so it's kind of unusual for axe murderers to go to that effort. They could have just waited for me to get off and come to the bus station, you know. So it wasn't to do with that, It was just to do with, I was in this beautiful valley in Spain, and just to do with my human aloneness in the universe. I had it really strongly that the hills around me, the rocks, didn't really care about me. But I could go for a walk and fall, and the earth wouldn't care. You know, this terrible sense of existential aloneness, it just frightened me. Then I remember I was lying in bed, I couldn't sleep. I was trying to think of something in my life that would make me feel secure. So I think about my sister. Oh, she's married. We got on really well. My mind trying to hold on to it. So that was all. And it would just keep falling off. And I'd just keep falling into this existential fear. And I remember doing a puja and chanting a heart sutra, which is, you know, the epitome of Buddhist wisdom. And it felt actually, for this moment in the heart sutra, I began to see it. It was like I'd been terribly lost, and just on the horizon I saw the lights of a little house, and that was my home. Oh, and such a relief. Oh, at last, you know, I'd been so frightened and lost, and there in the distance was home, you know, was safety. And I really had a sense of that in the heart sutra somewhere was this kind of safety. And it really struck me after that retreat that had I been positive enough and integrated enough, I could have let that experience must just burn me up. It could have just burned through me and I'd be home. I could have just done, but I couldn't. I was just so frightened. And I was frightened of letting go of me because it just felt too threatening to do that. So you won't be able to do it unless the practice of dying is impossible unless you're integrated and positively have enough positive emotions. So this first aspect then of integration, the epitome of it is practicing mindfulness, especially mindfulness and breathing. But I think it's all of those aspects of our life. So one of the things we can look at in our life is what do we do in our day-to-day life that encourages integration, that encourages us to be just one person. One of the perhaps areas we could look at is where do we feel like we are very different people? Where does that show up for us? When are we different? Are we the sort of person who has groups of friends that you don't want them to meet? I've noticed people sometimes get nervous around their birthday. They have a party because suddenly so-and-so is going to meet so-and-so. Your work friends are going to meet your group of friends. How are they going to get on? You know, so are there aspects of your life like that where you keep people apart? And I wonder why we do that. It's as if it seems to me that we sometimes have a different ethical standard for different groups of people. So if they're your friends in the pub, you have a different sort of, you can say different things than you can here at the Buddhist Centre. Because what we're trying to do in spiritual life is integrate around the best of us, aren't we? How do we do that without simply merely behaving nicely with nice people? How do we integrate the whole of ourselves? So for instance, I think we can have a different ethical life with our partner, you know, the person we're in a sexual relationship with. We end up sometimes saying things and doing things in that situation and acting in a way in that situation that we wouldn't act in this situation. Sometimes I'll say with our old friends, we can find ourselves in a different kind of ethical attitude. So that might be one area to start looking at. In what sense are we different people in different situations? This is even a point for things like what I'm doing now. You know, here I am sitting in front of you. Am I a different person now than I am on Saturday when I'm looking after the children? I am a bit, not too much, but I am a bit. What I should be is more and more the same person wherever you meet me. whether I'm staying at Arishara, whether I'm on the train going home, whether I'm giving a talk. Does it mean? You wouldn't want me to get better and better at doing this kind of presentation, but that isn't integrated with what I'm actually doing in my life. Now, actually, there's often a lag. One of the things about practicing spiritual life is you can get better and better at talking about it. You start to get lovely little stories people really like, the little metaphors, you get better and better at putting concepts together. And if you're not careful, you look more and more impressive. But what's your actual practice like? If you didn't mean this awful phrase, can you walk the talk, which I don't particularly like, but it is actually getting at something, isn't it? One of the dangers of order members is you end up telling each other what you already know, and not only that, but you're telling each other what you already know that each other knows. So you end up trying to teach each other to talk about, well, it's impermanent, isn't it? mindfulness or something. We end up, if we're not careful, when we're not being very aware of our spiritual life, and we end up just sort of telling each other spiritual sort of platitudes. And spiritual platitudes are no better than any other kind of platitudes. So we want to look out for that as well, where from an order member it would be not being a very different person when I'm up front to who I'm actually living. So if I'm teaching the Metta-bhavana, I need to be actually living out the Metta-bhavana. And to the degree I'm not, I need to be confessing that. I need to be revealing that to my friends. I need to be really working on that. Do you see what I mean? So that who I am in front of you just now really relates to who I am at home. So I'm trying to, order members are trying to integrate more and more around being an order member. So I'm trying to integrate more and more around being my name, Maitreya Vandana. I used to notice, I don't have this so much anymore, but I used to notice when I got in a bad mood, I start calling myself my old name. I thought it was quite interesting. I start using my old name to myself. It's as if that old name has to do with those old states of mind. Yeah. So it's any practice where you're becoming more and more one person, and you're noticing where you're not one person. Yes. I've got anything to say about it. But Sabuti and Bhante, in their recent paper, they're emphasizing it in terms of so you're a moral agent, so you can be a moral agent. It's a slightly technical language of it, but. So that you're the master or mistress of your own life, so that you yourself are in charge of your life, rather than fractured selves, sometimes one getting in charge and then another, if you see what I mean. It's very striking, isn't it, with being with children. I've got these nieces that are 4 and 5, and that they can't be moral agents yet. Although sometimes they're surprisingly moral, in a way that's really rather touching. One of them told me off, he said, she's quite right. I said, no, you're quite right. You should get annoyed. You know. But broadly, it's really obvious, they're so kind of changeable. If they get what they want, they're happy. If they don't get the one, they have a complete meltdown in one of their cases. To be a moral agent, you need to sort of be grown up, don't you? You need to be able to be responsible for yourself, admit shortcomings and so on, and be able to do what you think, like do what you say. So it includes things like, do you live up to your word? If you say you'll be a friend of me, can you continue to be a friend of them? Can you turn up on time if you say I'm going to meet you so-and-so on time? Are you hugely, very, very changeable, so that in one moment you're reliable and useful, and then in another time you're not reliable and effective? And yes, the great practice of cultivating mindfulness is bringing your mind back, especially to your body, again and again. It's interesting, sometimes just doing a little meditation like that, you feel a bit more integrated, don't you? Sometimes all you do is you've had a busy day at work, you come along to the centre, you do the mindfulness of breathing. Most of it you're all over the place. Thinking, oh, mostly what sort of happens, doesn't it? Yeah, you know. Yeah, must have. Okay, let's start. You know, if they could film us in our mind, it would be positively funny, wouldn't it? Oh, my knee, but oh, I must just. You know. My knee, all right, oops, sorry. We're kind of all over, we're a mess, really, basically.
Yeah.
That's my vision of some great. Hopefully, a mess in progress. I might be just talking to myself. But when you look at your own mind, it's a very messy affair, isn't it, let's be frank. And that most of our internal dialogue would not be publishable. not in a way that anyone would want to read. And it wouldn't tell a coherent story, would it? It would tell contradictory different stories. So, but you come along to a class, you keep noting, oh, here, am I going to do that again? And then actually, even with that little bit of awareness, You come out of the class with a tea break and you feel a bit better. Mm. By the end of the evening, I've noticed it so often, whether teaching or being in classes, by the end of the evening, I'm nearly always in a better state. Simple, isn't it? You come along, you haven't done anything really even very special. You've done this thing called meditation, but mainly it's been you thinking about, oh, I don't know how to get the bus home in the morning tomorrow. And I'm going to tell them, I've got another one. It's mainly been that, hasn't it, really? Some of you perhaps are deeper meditators than I am, but just by cultivating a little bit of awareness, you're in a better state of mind, yeah? So, all you need to, one of the primary practices, the sort of exquisitely Buddhist practice that we need to be going, is just keep coming back to our body. The Buddha talks about this again and again and again in the sutras. So you just come back to your body. Interestingly, his point of view is that if you don't like to do that, any insights you gain, any riches you have in your life, any depth of experience you have, he says it's like carrying water around in a sieve. It just all leaks out. And the reason it leaks out is because the container has got holes in it. And he uses that metaphor for the body. That without body awareness, everything you gain just kind of leaks out through the holes in your, through the pores in your body, as it were. It doesn't contain it. I mean, all of us have noticed, haven't we, this experience, probably if you haven't, you will do, going on retreat. You practice mindfulness more, you get yourself into a much better state, you come off retreat, and very easily it all just leaks away. Not even leak, sometimes you actually positive. You can wait for it to go to the sieve, you just sort of fling it out and go to the cinema, you know, and drink a bottle of wine and you positively evacuate it. But sometimes it just leaks away, and it's just because we're not cultivating enough body awareness. That's what the Buddha would say. Well, I'm not surprised. You need to keep on with that practice of body awareness. It's so difficult, isn't it? Because retreats, they're a funny thing, retreats, because they come to an end. And I notice that I think, oh yeah, this is great, I'm doing this retreat thing. And oh, what, it'd be really rather a relief not to do it at the end. You know what I mean? Have you had that feeling where you think, yeah, that was marvellous. Yay! Well, I feel a bit sad for going, but actually I get to go to the cinema now and I get to not sit in this room for all this time, which I'm thinking is marvellous, but it's not also rather challenging. Yeah? There's an aspect, isn't it, where we think, oh, good, I don't have to do that anymore because it's finished. Unless it was just me. There is that feeling, isn't there? You think, oh, that's a relief. And you quite sometimes coast on the positivity of the retreat, but very often you blow it a bit in that. And very often, I say you, I mean me. And very often we don't remember to carry on practicing. As if literally, okay, we did that practicing now we can get on with enjoying life again. And then what happens, of course, is that all the water leaks out and then life gets uncomfortable again, and you think, well, I really must go on retreat. And so it goes on, yeah. So that's the Buddha's approach to it, yeah. So that's in a way. So what I've done this evening, or started to do, is talk about these five aspects of spiritual life, integration, positive emotion, or kusala karma, receptivity, eventually, hopefully we'll talk about spontaneous, passionate activity, or nirmal effort, spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. And what I've tried to do there is start to think about what integration might mean. There's lots much more that we could say. So I've said, it's part of the great practice is mindfulness, particularly mindfulness of the body, exemplified in the mindfulness of the breathing practice. But one of the things we could also start to do is look at where we're living very different lives, where we're different selves, where those start to show up. Are we a different person publicly and privately? Are we a collection of selves or are we one self? And we're trying to do that so that we can be a moral agent, so that we can decide that, look, we need to work with us, that we can actually make decisions and follow them through, especially ethical decisions. We can decide to meditate and follow them through. We can decide that if we do get annoyed with the children, we're going to apologise. So any questions about that before we finish for today? That's my ramble so far.
Just a point, it might be a bit obvious anyway, but I'll ask it anyway. Mm. Like, you know, body awareness is a key to integration.
Yeah.
Why body awareness in particular, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know actually. I presume it's to do with the fact that the body is the most stable aspect of your experience. In a way, integration is to do with stability, isn't it? It's to do with wholeness, to do with stability. And of all the aspects of your experience, your body is the most stable, actually. I mean, compared to the vicissitudes of your mind, the inchoate, changeable, endlessly changeable nature of your mind, your body is very stable. It's relatively continuous. My experience is that when I'm more and more rooted in my body, I have this lovely sense of stability, of calm, of centeredness. And I think it's what people are getting when they talk about being grounded, which I don't quite always understand what it means, but I think it's getting at this sort of sense of being stable, being calm, being inside your experience rather than spinning around in your head. So it's particularly the other. So that's two things. And the third thing is, I think it's a antidote to acupuncture, which is this constant mental proliferation that we get into. Acupuncture means literally spreading out. We mostly live in this mind that's getting into acupuncture, spreading out, going over and over, thinking in our mind, spinning around in our mind. The great antidote for that is the body, the stability of the body. And I think that's why, and that's where integration builds from. I think the whole spiritual life probably builds from a very basic creaturely sense of our body, that we live like a cat or a dog in our body, that we meditate with our body, that we move around in our body, rather than just this head on a stick, that we become more and more in the West, especially with our obsession, you know, our involvement with technology. That's my thoughts so far. Yeah.
Well, I was going to add to that, but maybe it's also something about our senses.
Right, yeah.
Sense consciousness.
Yeah.
There's such a. Your mind's only one sense. You've
yeah.
got five other senses.
That's so
you're
right.
Not
yeah.
aware of those five other senses.
Yes. So you could say that spiritual life starts, and this phase of spiritual life is particularly to do with direct experience, the primary experience, that your senses are primary. So much of the time we're living in a highly constructed secondary reality of thoughts, opinions, narratives, predictions, and so on. Highly constructed stories that we've run, and that actually we integrate ourselves by locating ourselves more and more in primary experience through the senses, through touch, feet, sight, sound, living in primary experience and growing from there, rather than starting mid-air, which is where we so often are, in this weird cyberspace of constructed reality that we're trying to step out of. We can't just try to stop, because that makes it worse. We're trying to step out of it and step back into the senses, aren't we? You know, step back into the body.
I had a very interesting morning, and the fact that I found I was really sulking very early in the morning.
You were sulking.
I was sulking. I had a kind of feeling like I didn't want to get up and face the day.
Yeah, for her, yeah.
And I just got up and back to the office. Yeah. But on the way to work, I found myself kind of thinking about this evening and thinking about death itself, physical death, spiritual death.
Yeah.
And began thinking, how would I like to spend my last hours?
Yeah, sure.
And that quite sharpened me up quite considerably.
Yeah.
But the mind took over very quickly and started saying, we categorize this as this and that as that.
Right, yeah.
You know, and I found myself becoming very dissonant and kind of back into that kind of sulky, kind of heavy, cerebral thing. But again and again during the whole day, except for when I was actually in work, I found myself reflecting on this, my physical death as being a means of.
Well, I think that is a very good way of thinking of spiritual death.
Yeah.
That you are going to die.
Yeah.
And, it's a sort of cliche, but it is, you know, they say, don't they, that if you don't reflect on death before breakfast, you get distracted by lunchtime. you know, by lunchtime, by morning, the end of your cornflakes. But yes, I think just reflecting on your actual physical death is really vital, because that makes you want to live. Hang on, I'm alive now. I don't know what death is, actually, but I know that I'm alive, and how about I actually... It's so easy for life just to go through, to be passed through in this sort of haze of either sulkiness or, I don't know, it's never quite good enough, is it? And, oh, if only it were this, if only it had that, if only such and such didn't say that. And I think we all actually lie. It'd be the one thing you most want. A dog barking in the distance, a fan going next door. We'll be yearning for that when we touch. It means things that we think are irritating, the crowd get onto a bus. We'd love to be able to get on a bus at that time. It's very striking sometimes when you're ill, where you can't run anymore, for a start, or you can't get down the stairs so easily. Suddenly, your life, you just want to be able to, I don't know, make up some beans on toast, rather than anything else. So yeah, I think that's a vital reflection. And it shows again to see how that's you actually bringing into spiritual life the aspect of spiritual death. In this case, the literal aspect. Yeah. And you see how that needs to be there right from the moment you come in. And actually, it's probably one of the things that gets people to come to the Buddhist Center in the first place. Is some kind of death. You know, so often it's that something had happened to them that they really didn't want to happen, and that they would have done anything to avoid it. Partner leaves them, they get ill, their loved ones die. Something happens that you definitely don't want to happen, but you can't do anything about it. It's so often that brings us here. So how odd if you come here and nobody gets to talk about it, nobody says, yes, you see, that's part of the spiritual life that we're trying to communicate. So perhaps we should leave it there. It's a good place to finish, isn't it? Let's leave it there for this evening.
Thank you.